Chapter 29. As concerns interpreting the deity, I, this line of hieroglyphics was for 14 years the despair of all the scholars who labored over the mysteries of the Rosetta Stone. Figure 1. After 5 years of study, Champollion translated it thus. Therefore let the worship of Epiphanes be maintained in all the temples, this upon pain of death. That was the 24th translation that had been furnished by scholars. For a time it stood, but only for a time. Then doubts began to assail it and undermine it, and the scholars resumed their labors. 3 years of patient work produced 11 new translations. Among them, this, by G.R. Unfeld, was received with considerable favor. The horse of Epiphanes shall be maintained at the public expense, this upon pain of death. But the following rendering, by Gospodin, was received by the learned world with yet greater favor. The priest shall explain the wisdom of Epiphanes to all these people, and these shall listen with reverence, upon pain of death. 7 years followed, in which 21 fresh, and widely varying renderings were scored, none of them quite convincing. But now, at last, came Rawlinson, the youngest of all the scholars, with a translation which was immediately and universally recognized as being the correct version, and his name became famous in a day. So famous, indeed, that even the children were familiar with it, and such a noise did the achievement itself make, that not even the noise of the monumental political event of that same year, the flight from Elba, was able to smother it to silence. Rawlinson's version reads as follows. Therefore, walk not away from the wisdom of Epiphanes, but turn and follow it, so shall it conduct thee to the temple's peace, and soften for thee the sorrows of life and the pains of death. Here is another difficult text. Figure 2. It is demotic, a style of Egyptian writing, and a phase of the language which has perished from the knowledge of all men 2500 years before the Christian era. Our Red Indians have left many records, in the form of pictures, upon our crags and boulders. It has taken our most gifted, and painstaking students 2 centuries, to get at the meanings hidden in these pictures. Yet there are still 2 little lines of hieroglyphics among the figures grouped upon the Dighton rocks which they have not succeeded in interpreting to their satisfaction. These. Figure 3. The suggested solutions are practically innumerable. They would fill a book. Thus we have infinite trouble in solving man-made mysteries. It is only when we set out to discover the secret of God that our difficulties disappear. It was always so. In antique Roman times it was the custom of the deity to try to conceal his intentions in the entrails of birds, and this was patiently and hopefully continued century after century, although the attempted concealment never succeeded in a single recorded instance. The augurs could read entrails as easily as a modern child can read coarse print. Roman history is full of the marvels of interpretation which these extraordinary men performed. These strange and wonderful achievements move our awe and compel our admiration. Those men could pierce to the marrow of a mystery instantly. If the Rosetta Stone idea had been introduced, it would have defeated them, but entrails had no embarrassments for them. Entrails have gone out, now entrails and dreams. It was at last found out that as hiding places for the divine intentions they were inadequate. A part of the wall of Valadry in former times been struck with thunder, the response of the soothsayers was, that a native of that town, would some time or other arrive at supreme power. Bone Suetonius, p. 138. Some time or other. It looks indefinite, but no matter, it happened, all the same. One needed only to wait, and be patient, and keep watch, then he would find out that the thunder dash stroke had Caesar Augustus in mind, and had come to give notice. There were other advance advertisements. One of them appeared just before Caesar Augustus was born, and was most poetic and touching, and romantic in its feelings and aspects. It was a dream. It was dreamed by Caesar Augustus's mother, and interpreted at the usual rates. Asia, before her delivery, dreamed that her bowels stretched to the stars and expanded through the whole circuit of heaven and earth. Suetonius, p. 139. That was in the Augur's line, and furnished him no difficulties, but it would have taken Rawlinson and Champollion 14 years to make sure of what it meant, because they would have been surprised and dizzy. It would have been too late to be valuable then, and the bill for service would have been barred by the statute of limitation. In those old Roman days, a gentleman's education was not complete until he had taken a theological course at the seminary and learned how to translate entrails. Caesar Augustus's education received this final polish. All through his life, whenever he had poultry on the menu, he saved the interiors and kept himself informed of the deity's plans by exercising upon those interiors the arts of augury. In his first consulship, while he was observing the auguries, 12 vultures presented themselves, as they had done to Romulus. And when he offered sacrifice, the livers of all the victims were folded inward in the lower part, a circumstance which was regarded by those present who had skill in things of that nature as an indubitable prognostic of great and wonderful fortune. Suetonius, p. 141. Indubitable is a strong word, but no doubt it was justified, if the livers were really turned that way. In those days, chicken livers were strangely and delicately sensitive to coming events, no matter how far off they might be, and they could never keep still, but would curl and squirm like that, particularly when vultures came and showed interest in that approaching great event and in breakfast. 2. We may now skip 1130 or 40 years, which brings us down to enlightened Christian times and the troubled days of King Stephen of England. The augur has had his day and has been long ago forgotten. The priest had fallen heir to his trade. King Henry is dead. Stephen, that bold and outrageous person, comes flying over from Normandy to steal the throne from Henry's daughter. He accomplished his crime, and Henry of Huntingdon, a priest of high degree, mourns over it in his chronicle. The Archbishop of Canterbury consecrated Stephen. Wherefore the Lord visited the Archbishop with the same judgment which he had inflicted upon him who struck Jeremiah the great priest. He died with a year. Stephen's was the greater offense, but Stephen could wait, not so the Archbishop, apparently. The kingdom was a prey to intestine wars. Slaughter, fire, and rampant spread ruin throughout the land. Cries of distress, horror, and woe rose in every quarter. That was the result of Stephen's crime. These unspeakable conditions continued during 19 years. Then Stephen died as comfortably as any man ever did, and was honorably buried. It makes one pity the poor archbishop, and with that he too could have been let off as leniently. How did Henry of Huntingdon know that the archbishop was sent to his grave by judgment of God for consecrating Stephen? He does not explain. Neither does he explain why Stephen was awarded a pleasanter death than he was entitled to, while the aged King Henry, his predecessor, who had ruled England 35 years to the people's strongly worded satisfaction, was condemned to close his life in circumstances most distinctly unpleasant, inconvenient, and disagreeable. His was probably the most uninspiring funeral that is set down in history. There is not a detail about it that is attractive. It seems to have been just the funeral for Stephen, and even at this far distant day it is matter of just regret that by an indiscretion the wrong man got it. Whenever God punishes a man, Henry of Huntingdon knows why it was done, and tells us, and his pen is eloquent with admiration. But when a man has earned punishment and escapes, he does not explain. He is evidently puzzled, but he does not say anything. I think it is often apparent that he is pained by these discrepancies, but loyally tries his best not to show it. When he cannot praise, he delivers himself of a silence so marked that a suspicious person could mistake it for suppressed criticism. However, he has plenty of opportunities to feel contented with the way things go. His book is full of them. King David of Scotland. Under color of religion caused his followers to deal most barbarously with the English. They ripped open women, tossed children on the points of spears, butchered priests at the altars, and, cutting off the heads from the images on crucifixes, placed them on the bodies of the slain, while in exchange they fixed on the crucifixes the heads of their victims. Wherever the Scots came, there was the same scene of horror and cruelty. Women shrieking, old men lamenting, amid the groans of the dying, and the despair of the living. But the English got the victory. Then the chief of the men of Lothian fell, pierced by an arrow, and all his followers were put to flight. For the Almighty was offended at them, and their strength was rent like a cobweb. Offended at them for what? For committing those fearful butcheries? No, for that was the common custom on both sides, and not open to criticism. Then was it for doing the butcheries under cover of religion? No, that was not it. Religious feeling was often expressed in that fervent way all through those old centuries. The truth is, he was not offended at them at all. He was only offended at their king, who had been false to an oath. Then why did not he put the punishment upon the king instead of upon him? It is a difficult question. One can see by the chronicle that the judgments fell rather customarily upon the wrong person, but Henry of Huntingdon does not explain why. Here is one that went true. The chronicler's satisfaction in it is not hidden. In the month of August, Providence displayed its justice in a remarkable manner. For two of the nobles who had converted monasteries into fortifications, expelling the monks, their sin being the same, met with a similar punishment. Robert Marmion was one, Godfrey de Mandeville the other. Robert Marmion, issuing forth against the enemy, was slain under the walls of the monastery, being the only one who fell, though he was surrounded by his troops. Dying excommunicated, he became subject to death everlasting. In like manner, Earl Godfrey was singled out among his followers, and shot with an arrow by a common foot soldier. He made light of the wound, but he died of it in a few days, under excommunication. See here the like judgment of God, memorable through all ages. The exultation jars upon me, not because of the death of the men, for they deserved that, but because it is death eternal, in white hot fire and flame. It makes my flesh crawl. I have not known more than three men, or perhaps four, in my whole lifetime, whom I would rejoice to see writhing in those fires for even a year, let alone forever. I believe I would relent before the year was up, and get them out if I could. I think that in the long run, if a man's wife and babies, who had not harmed me, should come crying and pleading, I couldn't stand it. I know I should forgive him, and let him go, even if he had violated a monastery. Henry of Huntingdon has been watching Godfrey and Marmion for nearly 750 years now, but I couldn't do it, I know I couldn't. I am soft and gentle in my nature, and I should have forgiven them 77 times, long ago. And I think God has. But this is only an opinion, and not authoritative, like Henry of Huntingdon's interpretations. I could learn to interpret, but I have never tried. I get so little time. All through his book Henry exhibits his familiarity with the intentions of God, and with the reasons for his intentions. Sometimes, very often, in fact, the act follows the intention after such a wide interval of time, that one wonders how Henry could fit one act out of 100 to one intention out of 100, and get the thing right every time, when there was such abundant choice among acts and intentions. Sometimes a man offends the deity with a crime, and is punished for it 30 years later, meantime he was committed a million other crimes. No matter, Henry can pick out the one that brought the worms. Worms were generally used in those days for the slaying of particularly wicked people. This has gone out now, but in old times it was a favorite. It always indicated a case of wrath. For instance, The just God avenging Robert Fitz Hildebrand's perfidy, a worm grew in his vitals, which gradually gnawing its way through his intestines fattened on the abandoned mantle, tortured with excruciating sufferings and venting himself in bitter moans, he was by a fitting punishment brought to his end. P. 400. It was probably an alligator, but we cannot tell. We only know it was a particular breed, and only used to convey wrath. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.